Good morning. One of those admonitions we often heard as children was don't talk to strangers. Many of us were groomed, in fact, to be wary and distrusting and fearful. With good reason, I suppose. And still, according to Lord Jonathan Sacks, who's the former chief rabbi in the UK, the Hebrew Bible commands us only one time to love thy neighbor, but commands us 36 times to love the stranger. Hospitality to strangers is a core principle in most of the world's great religious traditions, and yet we only have to look as far as our own national conversation about immigration. Or closer to home, I'm embarrassed to say it, my own behavior behind the wheel, making my daily crosstown commute, to see that we have largely tossed that one aside. While we're used to hearing the expression a complete stranger or a total stranger, I'm struck by the equally common expression perfect stranger and by its unintended double meaning. Dozens of times in my life, I've encountered the perfect stranger. Just the right person at the right moment who offers the right kindness, the right word, poses the right question, or maybe points me in a direction I never would have considered for myself. To put that last piece in a more personal context, I do need to share that I've judged myself rather harshly throughout my adult life for not having taken a more conventional, linear path to professional success. You know what I mean, college, graduate school, good job, better job, make more money, then you retire, then you die. At the same time, I have taken no small satisfaction and even a little bit of pride in having chosen a more circuitous path. But I can blame a few perfect strangers for that, who have stood right in the middle of my path uninvited. One such person is a member of my home congregation in Santa Monica, Cassandra Christensen, who over 25 years ago stood in the middle of my path, held up a sign that pointed to this career of chaplaincy so many years later. Sometimes, if we keep our hearts and eyes open, a stranger can show up and point us in that direction that we never would have considered. Another example for me came in 1973. I was a freshman at UCLA, majoring in design, very focused on my future career and success. I also happened to really love dancing. And I was taking dance classes at the old Roland Dupre studio on La Cienega in Hollywood. I was even on scholarship, which meant I could take as many classes as I wanted for free in exchange for a few chores around the studio. That's because Roland thought he was grooming a future professional. I knew in my bones that that wasn't in the cards for me, but I went along with the program. Hey, I wanted the classes. I was a part of a small company of dancers who gave a one-night concert performance to showcase the choreography of one of the teachers at the studio, Chuck Moore. One of the other teachers at the studio, Joe Bennett, came to see that performance and was apparently impressed enough with my work that he took it upon himself to invite a friend of his, Walter Painter, a well-known choreographer at the time, to come observe me in class. He knew Walter needed another male dancer to fill out his chorus for a season of summer stock at the Sacramento Music Circus. Apparently, the whole class knew who Walter was, and they were all knocking themselves out and selling it to beat the band, and there I was, clueless. But I was the one who got the note after class. Michael, please call me about work. So I called him and he offered me the job. And my initial response, I'm a little embarrassed to say, was Sacramento? In the summer? Kind of hot, isn't it? What was I thinking? I was 18 years old. What better job could there be? And it certainly paid a hell of a lot more than selling bell bottoms at the Broadway or the May Company. So I took the job, and I had the time of my life. I worked my tail off, 5 shows in 6 weeks. You rehearse one show during the day, you perform the other at night, no nights off. I have the fondest memories of that summer. And it actually marked the beginning of a career as a professional dancer that I said I never wanted, that ended up paying for the rest of my college education. I just have such fond memories of that time. I still take dance class every Saturday from Walter some 44 years later with a bunch of old dancers. It's the highlight of my week. But I need you to hear that I didn't set my sights on any of it. Just like I never set my sights on this career of chaplaincy, I felt kind of led here. So what is it that makes a stranger sometimes more perfect for us than a loved one, a family member, a good friend? For one thing, a stranger generally has no agenda for us, no need to advise us or fix us or contextualize our lives for us on our behalf. More often than not, they're completely indifferent to us. And yet in our bumping up against one another, sometimes there can be an awakening, a revelation, a realization of a new truth, or maybe even a reminder of an old one. A few years back, I had a breast cancer patient named Dorothy, whom I would visit every week in the infusion clinic while she was getting her chemo. Her husband, Frank, came to every appointment with her. Frank was a bit of a grumpy Gus. He was kind of a curmudgeonly fellow. He was also a passionate collector of antique and vintage cars. He would restore them, fix them up. I listened to many stories about their cross-country trips to various car shows. One week, Frank was telling me what happened after the previous week's appointment. That week, he had chosen to drive one of his restored beauties to the appointment, and when they went back out to the parking structure after her infusion, he found the side of his car bashed in. Now, any of you that have been in that situation, as I have, you know that deep feeling of disgust and outrage. And he makes his way closer to his car, and then he finds the note pinned under the windshield wiper. Name, address, insurance information, phone number, apology. I had been listening to Frank for weeks talk about how disenchanted he had become with the human race, and here he was given this gift. Michael, I gotta tell you, it was almost worth the hassle of having to get my car fixed just to be reminded that there's still good people in the world. Now, it was Frank's creative choice to find the meaning in that ordeal, but it was the stranger, having done the right thing, that provided the catalyst. Sometimes a stranger can be a kind of teacher. In the late fall of 2009, my husband Scott and I took a trip to Eastern Europe, and we made a stop to Krakow, Poland, in order to visit Auschwitz and Birkenau. For those of you who have not been, as you might imagine, it's an overwhelming, devastating experience. We chose to rent a couple of those Acosta guides so we could tour the camps at our own pace rather than join a guided tour group, thinking that might dilute our experience. It was hard to know what to do with the sheer volume and intensity of emotion and feeling that would come up with each step rounding each corner. There were so many moments I wanted to say, stop, I can't take any more, I can't breathe, get me out of here. But I knew I had to. I had to bear witness to every inch that I could, that somehow it would be a sin not to. In the years since, there have been those who have asked, why would you have ever wanted to go? Particularly as a Gentile. I mean, I get it, it's a place of pilgrimage for Jews, but why was it important for you to go? It always struck me as an odd question. The best answer I have is that it's important to me to try to bear witness to the absolute worst of humanity as much as I would want to bear witness to the best of it. Not only to bear witness to it, but to also own that those aspects of humanity are alive within me too. Cruelty, hatred, judgment, indifference, apathy. I've always tried to embrace the notion that nothing human is foreign to me. It always seemed a little glib to dismiss the Holocaust as some kind of aberration committed by subhuman evil monsters. Thank goodness I'm not like that, huh? It was unseasonably cold for late October, bitterly cold, in fact. As we walked the camps, I found myself wondering about the more peripheral workers at the camps, who certainly must have witnessed the most horrific scenes day in and day out, and presumably went home at the end of the day to families and loved ones. Hi, hon, I'm home. How was your day? Is it humanly possible to compartmentalize to that degree? Just then, this sweet little stray cat rubbed up against my ankle. Purring his head off, he's winding his way in and around my ankles, and I squat down to pick him up to give him some love, trying to squeeze myself into a tiny bubble of sweetness and affection, desperately wanting of a momentary reprieve from all of this horror, and in an instant feeling so much guilt for wanting that reprieve and taking it, and in the same instant realizing I had my answer. That's how it's done. You simply move into another bubble of reality. That cat was my teacher. That cat was a perfect stranger. Not long ago, a colleague of mine asked me to go see Bruce in the hospital, who was dying from end-stage liver cancer. I only met Bruce the one time, and I only saw him through this very narrow window of critical illness at the end of his life. Still, such a narrow opening can offer a surprisingly intimate view, particularly to the stranger. Bruce is one who had lived his life on a very big stage, one of corporate boardrooms, international travel. His world had now shrunk to the size of this hospital room. Not having many friends or family about locally, his society had been distilled down to the doctors and nurses and housekeeping staff who came in to clean his room. Bruce seemed to be at a spiritual kind of crossroads. He wanted to connect with the Methodist faith he dimly remembered from his youth, but didn't know how. He wanted to pray, but he didn't know how or for what. It all seemed so hollow and empty to him now. So rather than launch into some lofty theological discussion, with Bruce we started closer in. And I invited him to reflect on the magic inherent in the smallest gestures of kindness, tender mercies, if you will. Oh, I know exactly what you mean, Michael. Just last night I had the most amazing conversation with the woman who came in to clean my room. Now, if you met Bruce, you would never peg him to be the one having a conversation with the housekeeping staff. But life had changed. The world had changed, and she was it in that moment. Michael, she had such a sweet smile, and she was so warm, she just made me feel like it was all okay. She even gave me a little gift. And his eyes filled with tears as he pointed to the little plastic angel over there on the shelf. I knew he had been touched by the magic of just being seen, of being witnessed, of connecting. I, for one, put my faith in that kind of connectedness between strangers, often, in being seen. A number of years ago, I was invited to speak down the highway here at the cancer support community in Westlake to an audience of primarily cancer patients. And after my talk, there was a time for Q&A, and a woman asked me what I thought was the meaning of life. Oh, that. Well, I'm trying to come up with some kind of answer. She doesn't wait for my answer. She wants to tell me hers, which was as it should be. And she said, I think the meaning of life is that everybody wants to be known, as in seen and received. I remember at the time my judging mind going into overdrive, thinking, well, that's way too simplistic, dear, but thank you for sharing. Are there any other questions? But I'll tell you, I have quoted her countless times in the years since because I think she came close to hitting it right on the head. I've experienced it too many times myself. I've seen it with patients whom I've walked beside too many times. The healing power in just being seen, received as I am in my life as it is now in this moment. About a year ago, I went to fill up my car at the local gas station. The USA station has lowest prices in the neighborhood. That afternoon, the place was jumping. I had to wait for a pump. A space opens up. I go to pump my gas in my car, and then it comes time to back away. And I'm checking my side view mirrors. I'm checking my rear view mirror. I'm checking my camera, and then I hear crunch. I hit one of those 3-foot-tall poles that's filled with concrete to protect the apparently very fragile concrete curb that surrounded the gas station sign. It was the one spot out of view of all my mirrors and camera, and I didn't know it in that moment, but it was a $1,500 mistake. Now, anybody who knows me knows that such a mistake is proof in my mind that I don't deserve to live. I wish I were kidding. I got out of the car to inspect the damage, and I hit it just the right way that not only the bumper, but the rear quarter panel and the hatch cover and the taillight were all damaged. The taillight lay there on the concrete like some wounded animal. I stood there in shock, staring at this catastrophe, contemplating my own suicide, and I was completely unaware of the man in front of me who was pumping his gas, who had seen the whole thing. Big, strapping fellow whom you would never cast to be the merciful angel in this moment. He comes over to me and just says, oh, man, that's rough, dude. I'm sorry. Said with all the compassion he could muster, not knowing what else to do, he bends over and picks up my taillight and he tenderly hands it to me. As if it's my wounded dog. And I take the taillight and I just put it in the trash. And there's a part of me observing this whole scene that sees how preposterous it is and even sort of sees the dark humor in it all, but I'm way too lost in my own grief and shock and self-reproach. But also gratitude for him. I knew in that moment that he eased the blow for me because he saw it and he got it. He knew how much it hurt. I couldn't thank him enough for his kindness. In our 39 years together, Scott and I have always had cats. And in December of 01, our boy Junior died. There has never been one before or since, quite like Junior Junebug. It was a Friday morning and Junior died at home. And Scott was en route coming home from a business trip to New York. I decided to stay home with Junior's body, thinking Scott might want to see him to say goodbye before we took him in to get cremated. So Scott's plane lands that afternoon, and he calls from the cab, and I told him that Junior's gone, and asked him if he wanted me to wait so he could see him to say goodbye, and he said, no, please, I cannot see him like that. Will you please take him in? So I wrapped his little body in a towel, and I put him in the car, and I drove him to the vet, and I sure didn't want to bring his stiff little body in through the waiting room where everybody's dropping off their dogs and cats, so I left him in the car, and I went up to the desk, and I choked it out. My boy's gone. Could somebody please come out to the car and get him? I went back out to the car. I held him for the last time, and out comes this little Latino vet's assistant, and when he sees me holding Junior, his shoulders just go. He just saw me. He got it. I kissed Junior for the last time, and I handed him over, and I got back in my car, and I just sobbed. I was completely unaware of the couple who had been picking up their German Shepherd, and they'd seen the whole transaction. And they walked over to my car window and knocked, and I rolled down the window, and they just said, can we drive you home? I did not accept their offer, but those five words changed my life. They imprinted my heart with an image of what it means to be seen, what it means to be kind. What is it that keeps us from being the perfect stranger, from being the one who's willing to say, I see you, I will be your witness. I will stand here and I will face my own powerlessness to do anything about it, to make it better. I do think that's it right there. It's not an easy thing to come close to another in their suffering, knowing full well there's nothing you can do to make it better. Nothing but maybe be a witness, but be kind. A year or so ago, I was speaking to another congregation, and this man came up to me afterward and asked, how is it possible for you to create these meaningful, intimate relationships with your patients? It must take a lot of time to build that kind of trust, huh? And I thought for a moment, I thought, you know what? No, it doesn't. It really takes no time at all. Hearts are already broken, wide open. The stakes are too high. It just doesn't make any sense to stand on ceremony and formality. Much in the same way, we might have a very meaningful, even intimate conversation with a total stranger we meet while traveling, particularly to a very faraway place. There we both are, away from home, out of our element, vulnerable. Just doesn't make any sense to stand behind the facades that we use at home. About a year ago, a friend of mine lost his elderly mother, and I called him the day after she died just to check in on him and see how he was doing. And he said, the crazy thing is, Michael, everybody keeps waiting for me to fall apart, my partner, my friends, even me, and of course I don't, but I'm finding it strangers that get past my defenses in a way that those closest to me just can. About 6 years ago, I had a patient, Randy, early 50s, stage 4 colon cancer. I had so many wonderful conversations with Randy over the last 2 years of his life. Not long before he died, I was walking him out of the clinic, and we were standing out in the hallway still gabbing, and up walks another patient, gingerly making her way to the entrance of the clinic on a walker. And Randy says, just a minute, Michael, and he goes, and he gets the door for her with a big smile on his face. And he comes back to me and he says, "You see, Michael, the way I see it, that's my job now, to be kind." Randy's life is one that had been animated by high stress, professional success, commercial real estate. He was all over that. And now his professional life had been distilled down to that as one who gives kindness, period. Cancer had robbed nearly everything from him, but it hadn't robbed him of that career opportunity. It hadn't robbed him of that place to still find meaning in his life. 10 years ago or more, I remember seeing an interview with Bill Moyers and Pema Chodron, the well-known Buddhist teacher and author. They were talking about New York after 9/11. And Bill Moyers was commenting on how after 9/11, New Yorkers weren't behaving like New Yorkers at all, that they were really watching out for each other and taking extra care. And slowly, as things got back to normal, they started acting like New Yorkers again. And Pema suggested that's because after 9/11, New Yorkers really understood in a bone-deep way the groundless nature of life. And when we really get it, that life is indeed groundless, that there is nothing to hold on to, the only response that makes any sense at all is kindness. Kindness to others, kindness to ourselves. It is so deceptively simple. It is such a wildly undervalued virtue. And yet, I believe it is the pathway to becoming that perfect stranger. And in recognizing and feeling some gratitude for the kindnesses shown to us, we get to experience the magic of so many perfect strangers in our midst, particularly from those who are willing to drive us all the way home. So be it.